After winning an Oscar in 2017 for Moonlight, director Barry Jenkins is back with If Beale Street Could Talk. This time, he adapts a James Baldwin novel for the screen.
Kiki Layne stars as Tish, and Stefan James plays Fonny. They're two young lovers who find their lives disrupted when Fonny is imprisoned for a crime. It's a crime Tish sets out to prove he didn't commit. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. And on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, we talk Beale Street. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And joining us from the New York Times is our pal Aisha Harris. Hi, Aisha.
Hi, everyone.
When we talk about Beale Street, as we said, it's a James Baldwin novel. This cast, Stefan James, Kiki Layne, also Regina King, who just won a Golden Globe for her role as Kiki's mother. It is a sprawling cast, we might say, yeah. Full of super awesome people. Brian Tyree Henry is in it. And Glenn, what are your feelings about Beale Street in general? What's your bottom line?
Remind me, Linda, when you wrote the review for this for NPR, did you use the word luminous?
I have it written down in my notes.
Because everybody else did. So I'm just curious. Do you remember if you said luminous?
I don't remember. I think what makes people say that is the way Barry Jenkins treats faces.
Yeah.
And I think that is true going back to Moonlight.
Yeah. There are certain words that critics keep in their back pocket and rarely use. Words like luminous and transporting and soaring and lyrical, and they all fit. And all of it is done in service to depicting this burning passion between Tish and Fonny at the heart of the movie. It's also in service, however, and this is getting less attention, I think, to this sense of outrage, this sense of injustice, this anger. It's also in service to a sense of family coming together, of community, depicted very accurately, really. Like there's a scene where Fonny and the landlord are trying to determine whether or not a refrigerator will fit into this loft space that they want to get. And so they mime fitting the refrigerator in. And that just felt like it's this tiny specific moment in the middle of all
this
flourish.
It's a bit of business.
It's a bit of business,
yeah.
Exactly. You do feel the debt to Douglas Sirk melodrama in the use of color and the music. And we can argue about this, but in the depiction of the racist cop. And as a follow-up to Moonlight, I did feel him going back to certain techniques that were effectively there. So like the sense of having a character stare down the barrel of the lens, which brings you up short because it only happens a few times in Moonlight. Happens a lot more here.
Yeah.
And I think it's less effective. But yeah, tremendously moving and, you know, luminous.
Yeah. Aisha, where'd you come down on Beale Street?
It's funny because the first word that comes to my mind is lush. Just the colors, the red of Fonny's jacket, the yellow of Tish's, I think it's her sweater that she's wearing. Like, everything about it, I see the Douglas Sirk in it, but I also see In the Mood for Love, Wong Kar-wai's movie from, I think it's 2000. I was really struck especially by the characters around Tish and Fonny. I think that their love is great, and I'm glad to see this depiction of Black romance in this way. I don't think we've ever seen it quite like this before, but really, like, all the supporting cast was what really stuck out to me. So Brian Tyree Henry, who we've already mentioned, who has this amazing centerpiece moment in the film, where he's only in one sequence, and he plays an old friend of Fonny's, and he comes back and he talks about how he did a stint in jail and how he was there unjustly. It's a moment where Barry Jenkins is kind of zooming in on Brian Tyree Henry's face, and he's telling the story, and there's like this slight undertone, this underscore of music that's just kind of very ominous. And man, he's not getting as much attention when it comes to the acting circuit, on the award circuit, but like that scene is you're at the Oscars, he's nominated, and that's the scene, like that moment is what you show. Like that's the clip you show.
I'd be happy for him to Judi Dench and
yeah.
for this movie.
Yeah. I mean, he has been in so many good things recently.
Yeah, he's had a good run.
So good in Widows. He's so good in Atlanta. He's so good in this. He's amazing in an episode of the HBO anthology series, Room 104. If you like him, track that down. Stephen, what are your Beale Street thoughts?
Well, I do have luminous in my notes. I also have the word sumptuous, which is one that I come back to again and again. This is such a feast for the senses. It's so beautifully shot. The music by Nicholas Britell, who also did the music for Moonlight, works on Adam McKay's movies as well. This score is absolutely gorgeous, and yeah. I think really captures the mood of not only this kind of swoony romance, that music that's in the trailer that you're just like, oh my God, this movie looks so romantic, but it also captures the darker undertones. I mean, this is a very bittersweet romance. This is a movie about compromise and sacrifice. And, you know, when we talk about how race is covered in movies, we often see race through the prism of how two people get along, how a movie like Green Book, where a white man and a black man learn to become friends. And this is a movie about race that is about the systems that create injustice. And the vehicle for telling that story is this romance. But you do leave this movie with a sense of quiet outrage yeah. that is very palpable and very different from how I have felt walking out of other movies that are telling stories about race in ways that make you angry. There's something muted about it in a way that made me think about it for a lot longer.
Yeah, for me, what it is, if you think about a film like The Hate U Give, yeah. Which also came out in 2018, which I also think was a terrific movie, but the angle on the injustice that happens in that film is more about when the person left behind is dealing with their grief, and it's all about kind of the pain of that injury.
Right.
And although Beale Street does deal a lot with the pain of the injury, they're also very careful to build this world that shows you the joy that is lost, that yeah. he should be able to have, that there is this beautiful love story that cannot, you know, that he can't have and she can't have. When Aisha talks about how important it is to portray black romance, I think there's a coming together of the romantic aspect and the kind of the injustice aspect that shows you that one of the things that happens when these unjust things come to pass is that, you know, happy lives are not able to happen. It's not just the suffering while you're in prison. It's the blank space that is left by the happiness that you can't have. Am I making sense, Aisha, or no?
No, I completely agree with that. And I think that the other aspect of this is just it shows really plainly the ripple effect that this injustice has, because we see all of the family members. We see Tish's mother and her father and Fani's father trying to do whatever they can possible to help get him out. And Tish's sister, who is played by Tiona Paris, Ernestine, she has a connection to this white lawyer who's played by Finn Wittrock. And it is interesting to me to see sort of, and this is very similar to the book, where we have this very obvious racist white cop who is the reason Fani is in jail. But then we also have these, I don't want to call them quote unquote good white people, but that's kind of what they are. Mm-hmm. There's a really striking scene with Finn Wittrock. Tish says in voiceover about how he's tried to like penetrate the upper echelon of the legal system, but he's kind of a low on the totem pole, and he just enters this room, and Barry Jenkins films it in this very like kind of dark and sexy, but also dark and sexy and threatening mm-hmm. way, where it's just a bunch of rich old white guys who like are the ones who are impeding justice. And yeah. so like seeing that balanced out with the racist white cop, I think, was just a very interesting way to take it. And I appreciated it. I liked that aspect of it.
Yeah. And I think all three of you have answered something that I've seen various critics grappling with. Not critiques, not a full-throated critique, but an open question, which is that, okay, this film is so elaborately wrought, it's so elegantly composed, it's a richly constructed aesthetic jewel, and what it's dealing with is the great open wound on the American soul. Mm-hmm. You know, the legacy of slavery and institutionalized racism. And then what they're asking is, if dressing up such ugliness in such a gorgeous gift box risk leeching some of the urgency, some of the anger that any depiction of such a systemic injustice should inspire, I have my own answer to it, but you've all been saying it's not an either-or deal here.
Right, exactly.
And I think Linda rebutted that argument perfectly when she talked about this movie showing the lives that are disrupted. And I think that is an incredibly important part of obviously a much, much larger picture of these systems. I mean, I talked before about compromise and sacrifice. And Aisha, you know, you mentioned the ripple effects on the family. I mean, there are members of this family who are basically forced into a life of crime to try to raise the money to combat this injustice. where you have wrongs begetting wrongs begetting wrongs, which can reverberate well beyond this initial injustice.
Well, and I think it does a good job of, to the point Glenn was making, the other reason why I'm not troubled by that, it makes sense to give roundness to people's lives and understand that a Black character's life in a movie about injustice, that character's entire life is not about that moment of injustice.
Right,
it's
right.
not, the person is not defined by being a victim of racism. They may be. And that's why I love the fact that the rest of it is so tender and could come out of, you know, a regular romantic film. There is a sex scene in this film that reminded me more than anything of the sex scene in Love and Basketball, which is an incredibly kind of gentle, realistic, to me, very realistic picture of what it is actually like when people have sex for the first time, much more than in most films. There's a wonderful scene where when Tish is explaining to her family that she's pregnant, you're primed to believe that that is going to be a scene where the family gets all upset and the parents right. are angry. And what you get is this family that's very supportive of her and very kind of celebratory. This is going to be a baby. It's a good thing. And it's not, it builds so much warmth in the family. And there's a really funny scene that involves Fonny's sisters and Tish's sister
yeah.
that I love and I could watch 100 times in a row.
Yeah. And my answer to that question about the quote-unquote conflict between aesthetics and urgency is that just as a feat of adaptation, what Jenkins is doing is capturing the experience of reading James Baldwin's gorgeous, luminous prose.
There it is.
But urgent.
But urgent. See, Baldwin isn't Hemingway. He has no interest in being Hemingway. He has no interest in that clarity above all, just the facts BS. He is an interlocutor. He's between you and the events. His writing is beautiful and angry at the same time. You can have gorgeous urgency. Who says you can only make ugly films about racial injustice? You know,
right.
why are we, and people aren't. I want to make this clear. They're just sort of questioning, is this, what does this do to the message? What does this do to driving you out of the theater, as Stephen was saying, like feeling something that you grapple with as opposed to, you know, it's not Spike Lee.
Aisha, how do you feel like it works as an adaptation of the book?
Well, I actually encountered the book for the first time in preparation for the movie. I wanted to read it and before seeing it. And so it was very fresh in my mind while I watched the movie for the first time. And Jenkins actually, he was pretty closely to the book, especially a lot of lines in the film are directly taken from the book. And I think he does do a really good job of capturing that, especially the intimacy that is in the book. The book is actually very graphic in its the way Tish narrates the first time that they've had sex in ways that I was like, oh, wow, like 50 Shades has got nothing on what Baldwin has written about how like what her experience is like with Fonny for the first time. And I really think that he was, especially that scene of the first time they come together, it just does a really great job of capturing that. It just hangs there and you can feel it. And it is just beautifully shot and tender and loving. And I mean, I wish my first time had been like that.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
And, yeah, I just thought it was beautiful.
Yeah. And my big obsession this year when I was at Toronto was looking at the use of color in film. And it kind of makes sense when we talk about lush and sensuous and luminous and all that stuff. But when you see this film, look for the use of color. Mm-hmm. Look for the way in the very opening scene, they are walking under a kind of a canopy of gold fall leaves. It matches the color of her sweater. It matches the color of his collar. And it puts them very much at home in the world that they're in. It creates a lot of harmony where their lives are happy. And throughout the film, you see moments where, you know, she is dressed in different ways depending on where she is. And it's really worth paying attention to that stuff.
It's interesting. Between this and the TV show Homecoming, I feel like I spent a lot of time in 2018 on entertainment in which the face of Stephan James is very lovingly photographed.
Yeah.
That man has a beautiful, beautiful face.
He really does.
And he is so terrific in this. And I'm so happy to see, I was so happy to see Regina King win the Golden Globe. But there are people in this movie, you mentioned Brian Tyree Henry, I felt the same way awards-wise about Stephon James between this and Homecoming, but also about Colman Domingo, who plays Tish's dad, who has, you know, he's a veteran actor. He, you look at his IMDb page, it is long. Mm-hmm. And he's done a lot of stage work. And he is such an interesting character because it is this mix of this intense fatherly love mixed with a willingness to do absolutely whatever it takes for you know, for his kids. And that is a really rich portrait that I really just adored.
Yeah, I think it's terrific, and we are not the first to say so, but a beautiful, beautiful film. And if you have a chance to seek it out, it's kind of been broadening out. I feel like the rollout was a little bit quiet, but it is in more theaters now. So if you look for it, you may be able to find If Beale Street Could Talk. It's a beautiful movie, and we do recommend it. And when you see it, do tell us what you think about it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. After a quick break, it's going to be time to talk about what's making us happy this week, so come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Syfy. From executive producers The Russo Brothers, survival is extra credit in Syfy's new series, Deadly Class. Set in the unsanitized counterculture of the 1980s, a disillusioned teen is recruited into King's Dominion, a secret academy for the deadly arts. Based on the graphic novel by Rick Remender and Wes Craig, Deadly Class premieres January 16th on Syfy. Watch the first episode now at deadlyclass.syfy.com. Support also comes from NPR sponsor National Geographic and the new series Valley of the Boom. From executive producer Ariana Huffington and starring Lamorne Morris, Bradley Whitford, and Steve Zahn, Valley of the Boom tells the story of the birth of the browser, of the first social network hatched in a dorm room, and of the epic fails of early streaming. Valley of the Boom premieres Sunday, January 13th at 9, 8 Central on National Geographic. Watch the first two episodes now on demand and on the Nat Geo TV app.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Steve and Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
I've never gotten to write or speak about one of my very favorite albums of 2018 called Now Only by a guy who performs under the name Mount Eerie. Now, one of the reasons that I have never talked or spoken about this particular record is it is one of the most depressing pieces of music I have ever heard in my life. And I can
on brand.
The devil, you say, in the Glenn Weldon pool of responses to that statement. Imagine the movie Amour, but sadder and set to music. The story behind this record is incredibly sad. The singer Phil Elverum, who's been making kind of self-releasing this really beautiful, rich, kind of sad, arty music for more than 20 years. His wife, Genevieve Kestre, who was also a musician, died in 2016. And he made a pair of albums about her. One is called A Crow Looked at Me, and this one is called Now Only. And I would play a little piece of this music, but it is impossible, I think, to excerpt it in a way that captures the cumulative experience of it, which is you are hearing these incredibly vivid and detailed discussions of this woman he loves and her life and death and the aftermath. And it is crushingly sad and beautiful music. And the coda to this story is that Phil Elverum was recently on the cover of Us Weekly magazine, which is almost impossible to imagine if you're familiar with the catalog of Phil Elverum, the musician, because he recently and quietly married the actress Michelle Williams. Mm-hmm. And that they, and who has obviously experienced her own loss with Heath Ledger. The two of them just kind of quietly slipped away and got married. And I got to pick up a recent issue of Us Weekly and see one of my favorite sad musicians.
Yeah. and it's just a nice story.
It's a nice, very bittersweet and beautiful story, and that story is so much richer if you spend the time with these two records. They put love and romance in this completely different context that I have really valued. I love these records so much. The most recent one is Now Only. They're on all your favorite streaming services.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
Musical pillow smothering.
Yeah.
basically. No. Okay, so last year I did a piece for ATC asking, why haven't Hollywood movies really grappled with online dating in any kind of way? You have people on TV swiping right and left all the time. They show the text on the screen, but films are lagging way behind. So I asked a couple directors and producers, and what they basically said was, A, it's a numbers game. There just aren't that many romantic dramas or comedies being made right now. B, it's not that cinematic. We haven't cracked how to depict it in an interesting or fresh way. There's a little film called Dating My Mother, written and directed by Mike Roma, that has cracked it. It's streaming on Amazon and other places. It's about a young, gay Hollywood screenwriter. Wait, hear me out. I know what you're thinking. Who goes back home to suburbia to live with his single mom and lick his wounds, the jokes. They land. The characters are allowed to be real and rounded. The mom's not a cartoon, and that was important to me. But when it comes to depicting online dating in a fresh, funny, visually inventive, clever way, the movie nails it. So that is Dating My Mother on Amazon and elsewhere.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Aisha Harris, what is making you happy this week?
The Reginas are making me happy this week, mm-hmm. also known as Regina King, who we've already talked about in If Beale Street Could Talk, and also Regina Hall, who was wonderful in Support the Girls, which is another movie I think everyone should definitely check out. I actually had the pleasure, I was a guest at the New York Film Critics Circle Awards, and both Reginas received awards for their roles in those movies, and it was lovely to see them both there. When Regina King went up on stage, she said, I love that the Reginas are here, and everyone in the audience was just like, aw. It was just like such a sweet moment. And then like Regina Hall, when she went up, she also acknowledged the other Regina and then also went into a weird but lovely spiel about how she had a crush on Steve Martin because Steve Martin was also there. So it was a delightful night. Anyway, the Reginas are making me happy, especially just because these are both actresses who have been, their careers are very long, their resumes are very impressive, but it's great to see them sort of evolving from where they started in their respective careers. I think, you know, for a while, Regina Hall was probably best known by a lot of people, at least people who weren't black, for Scary Movie. And Scary Movie's great. She's great in that movie, but she can do so much more. And it's great to see her do that and Support the Girls. And diddle Regina King, who, you know, she started in 227, had bit parts in like Boys in the Hood, and has now really blossomed into like your go-to actor, filmmaker. She directs a lot of stuff on TV. So I'm just so happy that they're finally getting the recognition, and I want to continue seeing everything that they do. So the Reginas are making me happy.
Yeah, and I believe that Support the Girls has now made it to Hulu. So if you have Hulu, you can check it out even more easily. Thank you, Aisha Harris. I am happy this week. It's funny because I'm in the middle of a bunch of things. I'm particularly in the middle of reading a bunch of books. So I'm going to do a thing I wouldn't normally do and tell you about a book I'm in the middle of reading because I finished a section of it that I do want to recommend. And it's Susan Orlean's The Library book. Mm. And there is a section near the beginning of this book where she very specifically tells the story of the massive fire at the LA Central Library in the mid-1980s. And she tells the story of this fire with such specificity. This is what she does. She does narrative nonfiction. So it's like reading a novel, except it's, you know, a true story that she has heavily and carefully researched. And when you talk about a library and the loss of materials and the way they try to save them and the devastation of the fire, I can feel the book now shifting into more of kind of the question of who did it and who was responsible for the fire, which people felt from the beginning was arson. But the description of the fire itself is one of the most... It sounds sort of terrible to say I wanted to hear her talk about this fire for 20 hours, but it is a great, great piece of descriptive work. So what is making me happy this week is making my way through The Library book by Susan Orlean. And that is what is making me happy this week, and that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find Aisha at Crafting My Style. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, our producer, Vincent Accavino, at V. Accavino, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. If you have a second and you want to hear more from us, including what is making us happy this week and every week, please sign up for our newsletter. You can do that at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And we will see you all right back here next week.
This week on Fresh Air, Terry Gross sits down with comedian Kevin Hart to talk about his work and recent Oscars controversy. Find that interview and other long-form discussions with the biggest names in entertainment, journalism, and books in the Fresh Air feed.